You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Hey you, welcome to this week's episode. I have one of the best chats ever with Cameron Glover, who has a podcast called Sex Ed in Color. Andrew Gerza connected us a couple of weeks ago, and wow, did I love this conversation. There was so much chemistry and delight. I felt like I could have kept talking to Cameron for hours. And in fact, our Patreon bonus content goes on quite long. Usually those bonus chats are 8 to 10 minutes, and this one's about a half an hour because we just kept going deeper into all of our thoughts and the places we wanted to explore. I think you're going to really enjoy it. I also just want to remind you that having you on the newsletter for the podcast is becoming crucial if you want to stay in touch with the show. As social media cracks down, as websites are getting turned off and banning sexuality content, there is a chance that finding any information about the show and what's going on could become really challenging. So in addition to voting and getting different elected officials in office, if you go to sexgetsreal.com/books, you can grab the official Sex Gets Real book list that has all of my most recommended books for bodies and sex and relationships. It's a really wonderful resource that I'm so proud and excited to share. It's totally free. And when you sign up to get it, you also get added to the podcast newsletter. So that way, as things happen, milestones, live tapings, really exciting giveaways, because I've got a whole bunch of giveaways planned for 2019, you'll get to be the first to hear about it. So again, sexgetsreal.com/books. Also, if you're looking for support around healing your relationship with your body, deepening your intuitive eating and your body trust, if you're looking for new ways to connect with a partner, to unpack your desire and to find more pleasure, I would love to work with you. I do one-on-one work and couples work, and you can find out more about all of my coaching opportunities at dawnsarah.com. Those links, of course, are in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com/EP243 for this week's episode. Let me tell you a little bit about Cameron, and then we're just going to go right in, because I love it. Especially towards the end of our conversation, we have this awesome discussion about chronic pain and asking for more support. Cameron and her partner transitioned from a polyamorous or a non-monogamous relationship to a monogamous relationship, and how they've been navigating like non-romantic friendships as a way to continue to feel seen and supported. There is so much in here about community-only spaces and all the bullshit that's happening with FOSTA and SESTA. We have fun. So Cameron Glover is a sex educator, writer, podcaster, and bath witch from New Jersey. Her expertise in sex and culture has been used to write for publications such as Playboy, Glamour, GQ Mag, Them, and many others. Cameron co-hosts a podcast, Nerds of Prey, hosted by four Black women as they talk about nerd culture, and Cameron hosts her own show, Sex Ed in Color, shedding light on how sexuality professionals of color navigate the field. Here is my conversation with Cameron, and then don't forget to hop over to patreon.com/sgrpodcast. There's a new URL because I can't say that scary sex word a lot of places anymore. So patreon.com/sgrpodcast. Here our awesome bonus chat, pledge to support the show, and on we go. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Cameron. I'm ready to geek out with you.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You are so welcome. So you're out in the world doing amazing work around sex education and pop culture and writing and thinking about all the things. We're going to have a really good time talking about like chronic pain and horophobia, and my list is luscious.
Yes. And I'm also thinking of all the things that just will make themselves known as we talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's where I'd like to start. When we were talking about what we wanted to talk about today, the thing that you said you've been really kind of rolling around in and sinking your teeth into is unpacking some of the privilege and some of the experiences that you're having around horophobia, and the ways that everyone who listens to the show knows I've been talking a lot lately about FOSTA and SESTA and all of the censorship that the show is experiencing on social media. And so you've been thinking about that, and specifically the privilege that you have as a sex educator compared to people who are sex educators and also do sex work and or just sex workers.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear a little bit about what you've been really kind of trying to get into your bones and unpack around that.
Yeah. So it's interesting because a few months ago I did a workshop locally with a group, and we really dived into it. Was supposed to be focused on like just porn, but I ended up including a lot of stuff with erotophobia and whorephobia in that, because to me, I kind of see everything I do kind of holistically. So everything is really interconnected for me. And I didn't think that I could have a conversation about porn without talking about SESTA FOSTA, without talking about how we live in a culture that's very sex negative and oppressive, and also the ways that that plays out specifically with whorephobia and the way that we treat sex workers. And that really was important for me to do as well, because it really was an active way for me to really start addressing how I benefit from these systems, as well as somebody who does sex education, but I don't do sex work. And even though SESTA FOSTA still impacts my work, it impacts the ways that, you know, I'm able to navigate social media, how I'm able to reach clients, how I'm able to just like interact with folks when I literally can't talk about, I can't even type out sex on certain platforms. Mm-hmm. But in that way, still, like, that doesn't compare to like the experiences that sex workers are having. So I think that it's really important that, in the same way that I talk about my other identities, it's important for me to both acknowledge and like actively work to dismantle the privileges that I have as a civilian and make sure that I'm doing my best to pass the mic to people who are sex workers to really like do that kind of work and feel heard and feel seen and support them in the best ways that I can.
When the Tumblr announcement came out a couple of weeks ago and then quickly followed by Facebook community guideline updates that essentially neutered any kind of talk around sexuality, gender, there was this huge uprising. And of course, I was part of that, of realizing, wow, listeners aren't going to be able to find news about the show on social media platforms. And a couple of friends of mine who are sex workers really kind of laid into all of us. And it made me kind of sit up and pay attention to this too, of like, we've been telling you for years what it's like to be us. And back in April, when these laws were up for signing and everyone was doing the campaigning, people kind of tweeted and talked about it and then moved on with their days. And now here you are being impacted by the very thing that we've been dealing with for forever. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it was kind of like, get over yourselves.
Yeah.
Welcome. Here's our reality. And that really hit me of realizing I really do have a lot of privilege in this space and have benefited from it for a long time. And there's still a lot for me to really open my eyes to and learn about this. I love that we're having this conversation because this is not new for a lot of people who have been in very vulnerable situations and who are trying so hard to survive and make money and thrive, and not being able to see that is literally the epitome of privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it's especially important that we're having this conversation now because we're like, neither one of us identifies as a sex worker and neither one of us does sex work. So I think it's really important that people kind of stay in their lane and are talking to their communities. So for me, that really means reaching out to most of my client base, most of the people that I know are not sex workers. So I feel like it's important that I'm able to go into those circles and like, if I can undo kind of some of that labor yes. that's put on other people's shoulders. And like, I'm more than willing to do that because that's something that I expect of other people in my life too, where I maybe hold less privileges. Yeah. Right. And also too, I think it's really important to recognize that there's still action steps that like we can take, and there's still things that we can do in our circles as well. So like for Sex, Sound, and Color, like from the beginning, I was really adamant about putting marginalized identity at the forefront without it being the central focus. So for me, I felt like I can't have a show where I'm talking about sexuality professionals of color, which is already super broad and super like encompassing of so many different people, right? Without actively including sex workers yeah. in that, because sex workers are really at the forefront of sex education. And it's really just like enrages me how often they're pushed aside, how they're just like erased from the field. And I don't know, it's really interesting because like you're saying too, I'm still doing a lot of work to like unpack that. And I do want to recognize the ways that like I still hold a lot of privileges, and like maybe some of the things that I'm saying is kind of like, okay, well, people have been saying this,
yeah,
you know, but at the same time, like that's still valid. It's still important. And I think that as long as we're recognizing that and actively putting action behind dismantling that, then that's really important. It's not just saying, oh, well, there's nothing that I can do when there's so much that we can be doing.
Yeah. Some of the things that over the years have been revealed to me are things like colleagues in sex education who have wanted to go into doing porn or erotic film and felt unable to because they would lose their opportunities to speak in schools.
Mm-hmm.
Or sex workers who are also doing sex education and could not get booked to speak at university groups because sex workers just plain aren't allowed. They're completely mm-hmm. seen as not valid educators. And just really thinking about the ways that even within our sex education communities and within sex positive communities, there's this stratification of who gets listened to, who gets paid, who gets booked for workshops and brought back, who gets to run groups, and then who doesn't, and who's been saying these things the longest and whose voices we keep ignoring and turning away from.
Exactly. And it's such a like layered, nuanced conversation as well, because I keep thinking about a post that I made a few months ago. I was resharing something that someone posted from their Twitter, and it was essentially saying that we don't live single issue lives. So the idea that like sexuality is separate from all these other social justice, you know, topics and like things are, mm-hmm. is just like, that's not true. Like you can't separate sexuality from, climate justice and gender equality and dismantling white supremacy. Like, all these things are intrinsically part of this. And when I think of how we're having the conversation about SESTA FOSTA and including sex workers, and not just including, but like uplifting and like actively, you know, being behind sex workers, I think about that a lot too. Yeah.
That's one of the things that I think so many people who listen to the show have struggled with. And to just be really transparent with listeners, my listenership over the past like 2 years has gone down significantly. And the show is still very popular. I'm so grateful for everyone who listens and for who writes in. But there has been this dip because I think people are really uncomfortable with tying talk about sex and pleasure and relationships and joy and these things that people almost treat as like entertainment, which they absolutely can be, but tying that to disability justice and racial justice and all of these other social justice movements, fat activism. And I think a lot of people feel a lot of tension and discomfort with getting confronted with those things as they tie to sex, because so many people just want to be able to say, I just want to fuck and I just want to like learn how to get off better and I don't want to think about these other things. But this moment in time is revealing why that's so important for those of us who have the privilege of opting out of those justice conversations, like the censorship that has long been coming for sex workers and trans folks and people of color is now coming for more mainstream educational entertainment shows like all of ours. And it's not new. It's long been in the works and it's going to continue.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm thinking about like when the news of the Tumblr ban first like came down and people, majority of people that I follow on social media were pretty much like, where am I going to get my free porn now? And I was like, do you realize like how backwards that is? So instead of like supporting a sex worker directly and buying a $4 clip that they made, you know, like you're going to complain that you can't get access to stolen work on a free site. Like, it's just, there's a lot of things to like dismantle here before we get to that conversation. But yeah, and it's also like really frustrating too, because it's like, as somebody who has multiple like marginalized identities, it's like I never had the option to like opt out of any of them. Like, when I talk about sex, even just like as my, for my own personal pleasure, like it's always rooted in the ways that I navigate the world. So I'm always thinking about it from the perspective of somebody who's queer, someone who's Black, somebody who has chronic pain, like all these different things like go into that and go into my experience. So the idea of like being able to opt out and just saying like, oh, I just want to fuck, like that's cool because I want the same thing. But like, we can't just assume that everyone gets there at the same way and gets to the same point. You know, it's making room for all these different experiences to coexist. And I think that's what is so great about sex education and the sexuality field at large. Like, there's so many people doing incredible work coming from so many different vantage points. It's like there's something for everyone. But if we are shutting people out because they don't fit certain experiences or certain ideas of how we should be experiencing pleasure and how we should experience sexuality, then like, we're really harming ourselves and we're doing more harm than good.
Yeah. And I think it's so important too, to just be able to name all of these things, because I felt really sad this week. A friend of mine wrote to me and said, I don't know where to go to see like hot, sexy Black bodies engaged in sex in a way that feels like erotic to me as a really fierce feminist. And Tumblr had some stuff, but now that Tumblr is going away, I don't know where to go. And so I reached out to the amazing folks at Afrosexology.
Love them. Love their work.
Love them. And they wrote back with essentially, there's not a whole lot out there. And that makes us sad. And here's like two things that your friend might want to look into, but really there's not much. And that's not to say that there aren't people out there creating that maybe we just don't know about. But when you think about the kind of content that's really easy to find pre-Tumblr getting shut down with sex stuff, mm-hmm. or if you go to Pornhub, or if you go to, you know, any of the sites people go to for their freebie stuff. And hell, yeah. even if you go to the paid feminist sites, you know, if you go to Erica Lust.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Others. It's not, you know, that doesn't necessarily guarantee that right. you're going to find what you're looking for. Yeah.
Right. You know, and I've had the same problem when I've had men write in and say, where can I find like sexy fat men engaging in like great sex so I can see it on screen? And the answer is, if you want something that's ethical and feminist, I honestly don't know of any.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really sad thing. So even just thinking about it from the perspective of like who's getting represented as sexy starts to reveal so many of these issues that you're naming around like truly the politics of pleasure
mm-hmm.
and yes. why it's radical specifically for certain people and certain identities and at certain intersections of identities to step into pleasure and to say, I deserve to take up this space, because nobody else is really giving that space to a lot of different types of identities.
Yes, yes. And it's so interesting too, because even with my work with folks individually or in workshops, like what often comes up is this feeling of permission mm-hmm. and folks just feeling like they aren't allowed to be sexy because they don't fit this ideal of what is sexy. So I'm really interested, especially in the new year, to like work on helping people kind of unpack that and like re-navigate that. So not looking at what is the societal expectation of what sexy is, but realizing that like we are all individually sexy for all these different ways. And like, how do we uncover that? How do we do work to bring that forward and embody that in a way that feels good for us and also acknowledges our other lived experiences as well?
Yeah, I'm really interested looking ahead to 2019 at these two concepts of Leonore Chia, who is an amazing sex educator, and she does coaching, and
mm-hmm.
She'll be speaking at the Explore More Summit again this year, but she does a lot of work around reconnecting with our wildness and kind of unpacking the ways that so many of us have been domesticated.
That's so fascinating.
So women yeah. specifically, but also people of color, and the ways that like our ability to just exist in our wildness, whatever we want to do to express ourselves, to move, the noises we want to make, the ways we experience pleasure, how can we release those and let them take up as much space as possible rather than kind of performing all the things that we're supposed to do. So I'm really captured by that idea. And I'm also captured by how that ties into both the work of Audre Lorde and then Octavio Paz, mm-hmm. Paz around eroticism. And what does it mean to tap into the erotic, to express the erotic? And like the deeper I go into these thought leaders and these philosophers who have done all kinds of work, Octavio Paz, I think is how you say his name.
Mm-hmm.
Esther Perel quotes him all the time, but he's done all kinds of research about the history of eroticism through the ages around the globe. And the ways that we experience and express eroticism across millennia and continents really comes back to like poetry, because words can't capture the energy and the ways that we move and the ways that we exist in our skins and like relate to our flesh. And so just thinking about that permission that you mentioned
mm-hmm.
around who gets to feel sexy and what does that even mean kind of takes me back to that, those concepts of like, how have we culturally, by systems of oppression and institutions and just even within like pop culture and media, been taught to be small and taught to be performing what we thought would make us lovable and sexy and desirable versus expressing ourselves fully, even if that makes us really different.
Yes. Oh, I love that. And I love that you mentioned Audre Lorde, of course, because Sister Outsider is like one of my favorite books of all time. But I also kind of like cite it as a sexuality text, even though it's not explicitly so. And I'm also thinking about a new book that I just got. It came out last month, I believe, but I finally got my hands on it. It's called Beyonce in Formation, Remixing Black Feminism. And it's by Dr. I'm going to take a moment because I want to pronounce her name right. Umise Ike Natasha Tinsley. Yes. And it is, she led basically a whole undergrad course in 2015 about, it was basically titled Beyonce Feminism, Rihanna Womanism, and taking like the music that both of these women were doing and like linking them to the cultural history of Black feminism. So it was actually expanded on into a book, and it's a mix of, I haven't read it yet, but I'm really excited to. And it's a mix of like looking at specific like albums, so specifically around the Lemonade album that Beyonce came out with, and like weaving in parts of her own story and her own identities. But I think that it's really important that in the field of sexuality too, we're looking at the ways that people are putting out their lived experiences as part of sexuality. Because I really do believe that like we are all experts of our own experiences. So having texts like this, thinking about the works of like other Black feminists that I really look up to and respect in the field, Brittany Cooper does amazing work, Laura Witt, just like all these like really fascinating and like provocative and just like expansive thinkers in the field, even if they're not explicitly talking about sex, I think that it's still important to think of that as part of the larger conversation of what is sexuality and like how do people experience it. So yeah,
because I think when I think about like when I think about expressing ourselves erotically, I'm thinking about creation and what's generative. And creation means art and music and movement and connection and relationships and spoken word. And all of those are expressions of the erotic. So I love what you're saying about let's tune into the lived experiences that are being shared by people, because even if they're not explicitly talking about sex or genitals or positions or those kinds of things, the power and the creativity and the art that's getting created by people are the expressions of their erotic selves. And there's so much juiciness in there that we can learn around ways of being, which I think is when you like really boil sex down, it's ways of being and ways of connecting.
Yes. And that like so many, that's why like sex is such a, one of the many reasons it's such a fascinating topic too, because it's when you break down the question of like, what is sex, you're going to get so many different answers because people have different experiences, different interpretations. And it's important that like, I think as sexuality professionals, we're doing our best to like make space for all of that.
Yeah. One of the things that you had mentioned to me via email when we first were setting up our little date was that you're really interested in community only spaces within sex ed. And I think that fits in really nicely with this conversation we're having. So can you talk a little bit more about what you've been thinking about or creating around that?
Yes. So I think that, well, first what I mean when I say community only spaces, I think that it's really important that there are spaces that are created for specific communities and are exclusive to those communities. So tying a little bit back to like the conversation we were having about Sesta Fosta, how I think it's important that I'm specifically talking to other civilians about Sesta Fosta and like the impacts, as well as other civilian sexuality professionals. That's like an example of like community only spaces. So really in my practice, I'm open to working with folks, but I really hone in what I can offer and bring into the field on marginalized identities. So like really focusing on like talking with other Black folks, talking with other people of marginalized genders, people who feel that they haven't really been, they haven't felt seen in the sexuality space. And when I think about the ways that I'm thinking of like a specific example of like sexual empowerment. So like sexual empowerment is like something that I'm really interested in like diving more into in a new year. And like doing my research, it was really frustrating for me to see that there are so many spaces that are very binary, that are very like gender essentialist.
Oh god, it makes me so mad.
Yeah, and like even as like, you know, somebody with a vulva, I'm turned off by the idea of being in a space where someone wants me to like stroke my yoni and like, you know, using very like specific language, like that doesn't resonate for me. So I'm just like, wow, like this is super frustrating, but also like how frustrating must it be for like somebody who is gender nonconforming or someone that's trans is just like, oh, these are my only options. Like, of course I'm going to opt out because this just isn't safe for me. And even thinking about who's leading these spaces as well, because there's a very specific idea leading these spaces, I will say. And I feel like, particularly as a Black person, I think that there is a shared experience of when we enter into a room and we kind of see both who is in the room and who is leading the space. There's kind of a moment that we can have sometimes, or that, you know, I will have sometimes, of just checking out, because I know that what is going to be said and how it's going to be said will not apply to me. And I'm automatically seen as like the other. I have to kind of like do the additional work of both being in the space and also navigating what serves me and like leaving out the rest. So essentially this kind of like, this is kind of wasting my time also, because I feel like there's so much that is universal to sexuality, but also things that are important for people to feel like they individually are being centered and talked to. So having community-only spaces, I think, is really important, because if we're thinking about these different themes in sexuality, it's important that people are feeling seen and heard, and that their experiences aren't other and they're not pushed aside. Like, they're all important. And I think that everybody deserves that. So really dedicating my time and my energy and my skills to cultivating those spaces is really important to me.
All I want to say is yes. You know, like, I notice immediately when I walk in the space if I'm the fattest person there and if there's any other fat folks. And that immediately tells me whether or not I feel even remotely safe to open up. And I'm also thinking, too, like, so much around sexual empowerment and just so many of the things we talk about with sex. I mean, God help anyone that goes to a medical conference around sex. It almost killed me. But we put these bizarre gender labels on so many things that don't need it. You know, like, I'm thinking there's a lot of power in creating a space for people who are going through menopause and the invisibility and the confusion that creates. Let's talk about creating spaces for people with menopause. Mm-hmm. It's not about women in their 50s, right? Exactly. And if we're talking about like struggling with erectile issues or impotence, let's create spaces for people with erectile issues and impotence. It's not like men and their dick problems.
Yes, exactly.
And so I think we see a lot of that too in sexual empowerment, especially the ways that it's culturally appropriated so much from like Tantra and like, God, don't even get me started. But
is that the Patreon bonus content? I hear?
Perhaps it will be. Because we've got opinions.
I mean, that's been like my gripe since like day one of like doing the certification program. Just like, what is this? Why are we doing it? And why are we doing it like this? And I think it's important that like, I'm also like, I want to be very clear that like, I don't want all spaces to be community only spaces, but having the option there, like alone, can be so powerful, because then it gives people permission again to like opt in instead of the default being, I have to opt out. Right. And also like what you're saying too, about like the necessity of community only spaces too, is really making me think of a conference that I went to recently where I did not have a good time. And I felt, I felt all those feelings come up of like what happens when your existence is kind of an afterthought. And it was not great. I did not feel good, but it also really reminded me the power of the work that I'm doing and like the importance of it too. So essentially what happened was I went to this conference, and I, as somebody that has chronic pain, like it, bodies are bodies. It kind of just happens. And I just wasn't having a great health day. It was really hard for me to like do a lot of moving around, and I was very uncomfortable. And there was a moment in the first session where I was just like, I'm in so much pain, I need to lay down. But there was no space for me to do so. There were no like accessibility accommodations to my knowledge at all in any of the rooms. And so I had this moment where I was just like, do I get up and like, I'm going to be disrupting the entire session, or do I kind of like try to deal with it as best I can because I don't want to inconvenience everybody else? And like having that thought was so like frustrating for me because I'm like, I'm not an inconvenience, and any space that makes me feel like that is not a space I want to be in. So yeah, it was essentially like going to the sessions with that and like not really feeling like I was, having my needs met or that I was even welcome in the space, because in addition to just the chronic pain I was feeling, I also felt kind of, alone and isolated as the only, or one of the few, Black folks in the space. Yeah, and it was just not a fun time. So eventually I was able to track someone down that was part of the planning committee, and I'm like, listen, like, I'm having a horrible time. This is why. And it's really, it's really unacceptable that like I have to do all this additional work to have my needs met when like it's clear that this wasn't considered even like a possibility that like anybody that attends would like, you know, need additional accommodations for anything. And yeah, it's just like so frustrating because like I feel also in telling this story, there's like a feeling of, I don't know, is it my place to really like say that? But like, no, these are my experiences, right? And it's important that like we talk about it and like break away from this stigma that like if we feel any kind of chronic pain or have a disability, that like our pain is not a burden, and that we are not burdens, and that spaces should be thinking about us from the beginning and not waiting until like we're in the space to be like, oh wait, maybe we should like, you know, set something up so you're actually able to participate and like focus on what's being said because you want to be in the space.
Oh my God, there's so much I want to say. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So first of all, I'm so sorry that happened to you, because you're right. Like, that shouldn't be an afterthought. That should be from the moment somebody conceives of the event, they need to have people who understand disability and bodies as part of the planning committee to help with that. So... Oh my God, there's so much.
I know there's so much.
Like, there's so much. So like one of the things that's coming up for me is when people are in spaces where they feel pain, they feel unsafe, they feel isolated, marginalized, they're having to do a lot of labor, there's a lot of microaggressions. And I'm thinking even beyond conferences, a lot of people who listen to this show run and participate in play parties, are members of kink communities, put on workshops, you know, for masturbation and book groups and all those things. And when people aren't feeling good, one, think about, okay, so I just want everyone that's listening, think about how magical Cameron is. You,
and I'm very magical.
You are magical. You have incredible experiences, really thought-provoking perspectives. And when you're not feeling good, and all the other people in the space who aren't feeling good, you're not bringing those experiences, your perspective, your really thought-provoking and provocative questions and hopes and dreams to the space, because you're trying to take care of you, so you're not participating. So that's a loss for everyone. But even beyond that, like thinking back to my conversation with Stacey Haynes a couple months ago mm-hmm. about like abuse and trauma and somatics and embodied consent, like consent can't exist in a space when people aren't present and embodied, when they're dissociated, when they're checked out. So whether it's a conference where maybe you're doing work-related stuff, or it's something really pleasurable like a dungeon night or a play party, if people are feeling othered, they're in pain, their accessibility needs aren't being met, then how can they possibly really be present enough to check in with their bodies and say, yeah, this is something that I really want. At mm-hmm. this point, I'm just trying to survive, and I'm probably going to start going along with things or not really offering full answers, being my full self. I mean, there's so many layers to what gets lost and the potential for miscommunications and consent violations to happen because people don't have the ability to just be there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. And I have, well, not as intense, but like now I'm thinking of like times that I've been in play party situations too, and thinking about my own accessibility and like safety. And I'm just like, whew, yeah, a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. I also think that just like culturally, we have so much ableism that there's a lot of shame for people when pain comes up around sex and pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate that you are sharing your experiences and kind of helping to remove some of the silence around that. I get so many emails from people who feel desperate and alone and isolated, not only because they're feeling pain and they don't know what to do about it, but often because partners and doctors have dismissed mm-hmm. the pain. And so I think this is definitely a place where we need to be talking about it and sharing stories and offering support, because only through being able to reveal those things and make those truths more known can we then normalize all the things that go with that, like accommodations and changes and
and thinking of and boundaries too. Yeah. It's something that I'm thinking so much about. Like I'm in a monogamous relationship, and I'm so lucky because my partner is the actual best. but we have a lot of conversations about this too, because I don't know when pain's going to pop up. And sometimes it'll come up like when we're trying to like have sex or like during sex. And it's just like, you know, we kind of have this thing where I feel open and honest to like talk to them. And also like they do really well at like checking in very often, so it never feels like I'm interrupting anything, mm-hmm. which is great and a really good practice that I think that we have. But I feel like because we have this space where we both feel safe enough to express like if we need to change something or we need to stop altogether, like we also both kind of know that like it's not personal, like this is part of care. This is part of a relationship. And I think those are really important practices to carry. Like, even if you're not in a romantic relationship, the people in your life, the support systems that you have, how can you start to have conversations about boundaries and like what your actual limitations are, not as a way of saying like, these are all the things I can't do, but kind of giving other people a guide to how you need to be cared for. And like starting to think about it in that way has really like shifted my relationship with my own body, my relationship with like sex and pain. And I feel like I accept a lot of these things a lot easier now than I did before.
Speaking from personal experience and assuming that this is going to resonate with a few other people listening. Mm-hmm. I was in enough situations over the course of my life where sharing things got shut down or resulted in rejection that I trained myself it wasn't safe to say I need something different. And instead, I'd better play along and just do the best that I can with this situation because I don't want to be abandoned in the middle of sex or have a really derogatory remark made about my body and what it can or can't do. And ending up in a relationship with someone who really truly cares about my comfort and my pleasure and who wants to be able to make space for the things that I need so that we can have more fun took time for me to trust that. And I've had so many people write to me saying, I'm afraid to speak my truth because I've been going along or pretending with something for years. And the response inevitably is going to be this feeling of betrayal of why didn't you tell me this before? And so I just want to offer too that this open communication you've established with your partner is such a gift. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it takes time to feel safe enough to trust that the person they're with does have the capacity to hold their truth. So if someone hasn't been telling you something for months or years, that something doesn't feel good, I think we need to have a little bit of gratitude when someone does have the courage to say something, even if it feels like, God, I didn't know I was doing something you didn't like, or that this wasn't fun for you for so long. Those feelings are valid. And thank you so much for telling me. Let's make it better from now on, starting now.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Definitely. And I do. That really resonates with me as well. Yeah. Because it's also, yeah, it's such a process. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much to unpack around that.
There really is. Oh, that can be like its own episode in and of itself. Like, to be honest. But yeah, it takes time and it takes many conversations. But I think if the person is willing to listen and hold space, and like those can be great starting points. But also, if not, like, how can you be heard in other ways with different people in your support system? Is something that I've also experienced and had to think a lot about as well outside of this relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something else that you have written about and that I've been really excited about for the past like year, year and a half to explore is the ways that we devalue non-romantic intimacy and platonic love.
Yes. And I love this topic.
Yeah, I know, me too. When I think about some of my richest, most joyous moments, it's when I'm with friends with whom I have deeply intimate connections, and we're just like being ourselves and thinking huge, heavy thoughts and messing up, but it's okay, and laughing and touching and making food for each other. What are some of the things that you've been considering around non-romantic intimacy and friendship?
Oh, it's so interesting because I feel like this topic has come up more for me now. So kind of a bit more personal, like context, like me and my partner, we were both dating non-monogamously when we met. And then we transitioned into a monogamous relationship. So we both kind of had like a really good, I would say a pretty healthy, like establishing of like, we need personal time. We need time to spend with like other people in our lives and like time together. And like, that's all valid and that's all cool. And I think that transitioning into a monogamous relationship with all that, it was interesting seeing what got carried over. Mm. So for me and my partner, like we're both like very much introverts. So like having alone time is like really important. But I feel like I was anticipating having like non-romantic platonic friendships be like challenging to like recenter as like important, but it wasn't. And I think that it's really important to have these conversations because as a cultural narrative, like we tend to see like non-romantic relationships as just secondary and like other mm-hmm. to like romantic relationships. But it's like, that's not, that couldn't be farther from the truth.
Yeah.
You know, like my friends are probably some of the most important relationships in my life. And yeah, like it didn't stop when I got into a romantic relationship. It didn't stop with other relationships in my life. And I think that it's also important to recognize the work that goes into them as well, because across the board, when we think of what makes relationships work, it's communication, it's being present, it's holding space for other people. And like, I'm trying to not go into a tangent about like what is and what isn't emotional labor, but I think, I think there's like the short version of it is that I think there's a lot of conflation with emotional labor, which is a valid concept and like a very valid thing, but not everything is emotional labor. Or rather, I think that emotional labor is a necessity for any relationship that you have with anyone. There's going to be a certain amount of emotional labor involved in it. And I think that it's important people recognize like what they are and what they are not willing to do. So for example, if like one of my friends, I don't know, is having a horrible time and they're like, I just need to vent about like what's going on with me. Like if I'm able to, like I'm willing to hold space for them and like hold them, even if, you know, if I can't, like I will do what I can to establish that boundary and also validate how they're feeling. But that's part of emotional labor, right? And it's not that I don't want to engage with it, but that's just a natural part of any relationship. So I think that unpacking some of these like cultural ideas of like what is reserved for romantic relationships and what's reserved for everything else, it's like there's more overlap than we think there is.
Yeah,
and I think that it's, no, platonic relationships or not, like, they're all really valid and important, and I think that we can all, like, do more work in being present and just making the people in our lives feel good and, like, feel like, you know, I really appreciate you and I see you and, like, thank you for being in my life and, like, holding space for me.
Yes, and I'm so glad you bring up that emotional labor is always required when we're in relationships with other human beings, because we have totally unique experiences and totally unique needs, and so being able to meet each other and offer support as life ebbs and flows takes labor. But often where we get skewed is we have relationships in our lives, many of us, where the emotional labor is just so mutual, there's so much reciprocity that it doesn't feel laborious most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless someone's in crisis after crisis after crisis after crisis, and we start to kind of like, oh, this is starting to feel kind of heavy, this happens to you all the time, that's often an indicator that we've been putting out a lot and not getting as much back as we might need or want.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where we end up talking about emotional labor so much is often within the context of like heterosexual relationships.
Yes, I see that a lot too. And I think it's really interesting because it kind of, to me, it weaves back to that. Are you giving a lot and not getting any back?
Yeah.
And also, how do we have these conversations with, how do men have this conversation with other men?
Yes.
As well? Because it's not our responsibility to do it for us, because community only spaces, right?
Right.
How do men talk to other men about emotional labor and begin to unpack, you know, being emotionally present for someone is not something that is gross or feminine or whatever, or demasculine. Like, that's just what you do in relationships with people. So like, how do we do it?
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's really important of what you just mentioned around unpacking was, like, when we're talking about staying in our lane, being in community spaces with people who have shared experiences and shared identities, or when we're talking about, you know, really focusing on the people with whom we have shared truths, it's not to get together and to bitch, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if I want to use that word, but it's not like men getting together with other men and complaining about what nags their wives are. It's men getting together with other men and really spending the time to unpack and investigate and support each other in growth and to do some learning and sharing and educating in the spirit of we want to get better and we want to make the world a more equitable place. And so let's share that burden so that it doesn't feel like something we have to carry on our own.
Yes, exactly. It's also making me think of like the examples of non-toxic masculinity and like that video of Terry Crews painting a picture, and it's like, you know what? Yes, more of this, please.
Yes. Oh my God, yes. I love that more and more people are talking about like tender masculinity, nurturing masculinity, non-toxic masculinity. I mean, we could also have a whole episode on just like what the fuck even is masculinity, but since it's a thing that's important to a lot of people right now, let's talk about the non-toxic ways of kind of having a relationship with this nebulous thing. But oh my God, yes, Terry Crews is so wonderful in so many ways. And I think there are some really awesome men, you know, Imran Siddiqui is amazing and doing all kinds of work for men about unpacking masculinity in pop culture, and Jonathan McIntosh, who runs Pop Culture Detective, who puts out the best video essays in the world about masculinity and pop culture. I mean, there are people having these conversations in really, really awesome ways. It's just we need to help make sure that they're accessible so that other folks can find
Yes,
them.
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
So I feel like I could talk to you for 3 more hours, but in the interest of honoring everyone's time, you and I are going to go record a little bonus chat for Patreon. I have a feeling at what we're going to talk about, but we'll check in. And before we do that, can you share with everyone how they can find you online, find your podcasts, stay in touch, and get more of you?
Yes. So you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Black Girl Manifest. That is BLKGIRLMANIFEST. If you would like to listen to my sexuality podcast, Sex, Ed, and Color, you can also find that on Twitter and Instagram at Sex, Ed, and Color. You can also listen to the show through Simplecast or on Google Play or on iTunes or whatever podcasting app you're listening to. Don't forget to rate and review if you enjoy the show. And what else? You can also find more information about my sex education work, my writing, all that fun stuff at CameronGlover.com. And you can also sign up for my newsletter there at Linktree/Black Girl Manifest.
Yay! I will, of course, have all of those links to all of the things in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com for this episode. So thank you so much for being here with us, Cameron. I delighted in this conversation and I can't wait for more. So thank you for being so generous with all of us.
No, thank you, Dawn. This was such a treat, and I can't wait to hopefully come back and talk about more things with you.
Yes, I co-signed that immediately.
Yay!
Yay. Well, to everybody who tuned in, be sure you head to patreon.com/SGR podcast. Remember, I changed the URL for both the Facebook page and the Patreon page because we can't say that scary SEX word anymore on a lot of
Oh,
platforms.
God.
So please go to patreon.com/SGRpodcast to support the show. If you support at $3 a month and above, you get access to exclusive, can't find it anywhere else in the world, weekly content. And Cameron and I are going to go record a little chat for you there. So we'll see you there. And until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue. Treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the vocal few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
Don't be ashamed. Love is supposed to